let me say hello to the people who are out there. Part of an experiment to extend the management development programs to a much wider audience. So this is the class. I don't know if you can see it a little bit. There's about 25 people, and we're loaded with faculty members in the back. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We've got about 8 faculty people here in the room too, which means we're going to go bankrupt in about in about 3 hours. So this morning, Carl Moore and I are going to talk about two different aspects of strategy, sort of yin and yang. I'm going to talk about, I think I should address you and not the camera, but we're going to talk about, I'm going to talk more about strategy as a learning process and a bit of a different view of strategy, and Carl's going to talk about some of the really interesting sort of new innovations in strategy from Clay Christensen at Harvard and other people. So we're trying to open up strategy. So let me start by asking you what strategy is. I guess nobody ever heard the word before. This is a brand new word for you. Choice. Which?
Choice.
Choice? Okay, wait, I got to open this. This is my nemesis forever is trying to get...
There's something on the board,
Henry. Okay. Okay, strategy, choice. Anybody else?
Forward thinking.
I can just do that.
Steps to follow,
okay. Direction? Yeah. Anybody else? Okay. Sort of advantage over competition, okay. All of those words imply that strategy is from now into the future, right? This is 2010, and strategy is looking forward, right? And if you look in a dictionary, that's the way strategy will be defined, as a plan, intentions, vision, whatever it is. It's something from now into the future, right? So if I said to you, forget that, just tell me what the strategy your company actually pursued over the last 5 years or 10 years is, would you refuse to answer that question? You should. You have to refuse. Nobody defines strategy as what you did in the past. They only define strategy as what you're going to do in the future. You should refuse to answer that question. People do it all the time. They say, now we know what Obama's strategy is with regard to Afghanistan because we watched what he did in the past. Okay, not because we know what's in his head for the future, but because we've inferred some kind of pattern to his actions or his decisions in the past. So it's not a choice, just a choice from now forward, but it's also the pattern in the choices that Obama or some company or some competitor of yours, if you're trying to figure out their strategy, made. So strategy is looking forward, but it's also trying to figure out what happened in the past. Okay. Now let me ask you a question. If I said to you, what's your strategy? What's the strategy of your company today? You might say, well, I've heard the CEO talk, and this is what he intends to do, or I've looked at the annual report, or I've looked at the strategic plans, or whatever it is, and you can get some kind of statement. Similarly, if we go back to the year 2000, and I said, what's the strategy your company actually pursued? Forget what the intentions were in 2000. What's the strategy your company actually pursued? And you'll say things like, well, we went up market. We raised price. We improved quality. Or we expanded to Asia. In other words, you'll look at the pattern in the actions in the past, and you'll infer some kind of thing. And then if I say, now go back to the year 2000 or whatever year you like, and tell me what the strategy you intended was in 2000. Again, you'll go back to the annual report. You'll remember discussions. You'll figure it out. So there was some kind of intended strategy in the year 2000. Okay? Now, this question I do want you to answer. Was the strategy that your organization actually pursued over, take your choice, 5, 3, 5, 10 years, was the strategy your organization actually pursued the same as the strategy it intended to pursue at the beginning of that time period? And you have three choices. One is to say, yeah, we did pretty much what we set out to do. Two is to say what we did was pretty far from what we intended to do. Or the third is some kind of combination. How many would say the strategy that you pursued was pretty much what you set out to do? Amazing. Nobody. How many would say, maybe nobody will vote for any of them, how many would say that the strategy you pursued was rather different from the strategy you intended to pursue? One, two, couple, three. And how many would say there's some combination? Interesting. Something's going on here, right? Which goes on, by the way, in every group I've ever asked. There's something going on here. We use the word strategy in two very different ways, but we only define it in one way. Okay, and the way you can describe that is we have a strategy that's intended. We can call it the intended strategy. Okay, and that's what all the strategy literature is about. It's about developing strategic intentions, writing down strategic plans. This is what we plan to do, right? And then you have the strategy that's kind of realized, which is, you know, you made all these decisions every which way, and you learned your way into some kind of pattern that became the strategy. So I call this the realized strategy, okay? And if you realize your intentions, then I call that a deliberate strategy. And virtually all the literature on strategy is about deliberate strategies. It's about formulating and then implementing. And there's no mention, not much mention, of a feedback loop from implementing to formulating. The top, the head implements, the arms, the rest of the organization. Sorry, the head formulates, the rest of the organization implements. Okay? I call that a deliberate strategy, and I call this an emergent strategy. Okay? And according to the vote here, and it's been the same almost everywhere, is there's hardly and any such thing as a purely deliberate strategy. In this room, none. And there's almost hardly any evidence of purely emergent strategies. Okay? Most strategies, as you voted, are a combination of deliberate and emergent. Because if there's no deliberate, then you didn't do any thinking. You didn't think first at all. And if there's no emergent, you didn't do first. You didn't learn. And how can we describe strategy as anything but a thinking and a learning process? Controlling where you're trying to go, but learning as you go along. Okay, and that's the critical. So all strategies combine deliberate and emergent elements. Not all, because we saw exceptions, but most strategies. Okay, and that's critically important, and it's totally ignored in the literature. When a strategy fails, what gets blamed? Formulation or implementation?
It could be both.
Could be both. But what usually gets blamed? Almost always implementation. Why? You know why? Because the formulators are doing the blaming. You know, we formulated this beautiful strategy, and you dumbbells weren't smart enough to implement it. Okay? That's not always the case, but it's often the case. Okay, and if the dumbbells were smart, they would say, well, if you are so smart, why didn't you formulate a strategy that we dumbbells were capable of implementing? In other words, every failure of implementation is also a failure of formulation, because you should have formulated in order to be implementable. You knew who we were. You know we're a bunch of dumbbells. So why didn't you? It's your failure, because you formulated a strategy we couldn't implement. Either because we're dumb, or more likely because you didn't or couldn't think it through. Because the world is not as predictable as strategy people like to think. Because in order to formulate a strategy that's implementable, the world has to hold still, or else you've got to have been able to predict what worked and what didn't work. what would work and what didn't work. And if you can predict, then you can make deliberate strategies. But who predicted 9/11? Who predicted the economic recession? Who or depression, whatever it is? Who predicted, I don't know, take your choice. I mean, every day there's something else happening. It's not that the world is totally unpredictable. I have a quote later, but I'll read it to you now. It's from a South African newspaper. It says, a long-range weather forecast should be obtained before leaving because weather conditions are notoriously unpredictable. Think of that. What they mean is variable. They don't mean unpredictable. They mean variable, but they said unpredictable, which is kind of a cute thing. Now, if you take a bottle kind of like this, take a bottle like this, empty, with the cap off, and you put clear, you know, make something clear, like a water bottle, and you put bees and flies, get a bigger one, you put a few bees and flies in the bottle, and then you hold the closed end of the bottle, sort of like this kind of thing, you hold the closed end against the window. You see something interesting, because the bees are smart. Okay? The bees know that if you're stuck in the beehive and there's a problem, like a fire or something gets in, they go for the light because that's the hole that frees you, right? So the bees know that when they're in trouble, they go for the light. So the bees will go for the light, except they can't get through the glass. They don't know about glass. They only know about light. The flies are stupid. The flies don't know about light. The flies don't know about glass. What the flies do know about is just going every which way. So inside of 5 minutes, the flies are free and the bees are killing themselves. And the moral of the story is that there are too many bees making strategy and not enough flies. Okay? In other words, strategy is a learning process. It's an experimental process. You keep trying things. If you want to come up with a really interesting strategy and not just copy whatever everybody else is doing, your competitors, or what you've been doing in the... So much strategic planning is either about copying competitors or it's about continuing what you've been doing. Very little strategic planning is about really novel breakthroughs, unless it's capturing the learning that's going on all the time in the organization. But strategies don't come to be because you scheduled the meeting for October 12th. You know, you don't have strategies on demand. You have strategies when interesting things happen. I think I mentioned this in Lancaster about IKEA's legs on the table. Did I mention that in Lancaster? That if you that IKEA's the key to the two central components of IKEA's strategy, you could argue, are, well, there are a number, but two of the key ones. One is that they sell their furniture knocked down, unassembled, which enables you to take it home in your car, and makes it cheaper for them to ship and produce. And in their stores, you walk right into the warehouse. There's no barrier. You can go straight into the warehouse and pick your thing, put it on your thing, take it out, like a supermarket. Okay? You know how they came to be? A worker tried to get a table into his car, and it didn't fit. So he took the legs off. And then somebody, I don't know if it was the worker or someone else, said, hey, wait a minute, if we have to take the legs off, maybe our customers have to take the legs off too, so why don't we just sell it with the legs off? That's one of the great strategies of furniture business, came to be like that. It was a learning process. Why the warehouse? Because they opened a big, huge store in Stockholm, and the first day was inundated with people. They couldn't keep up. They had conventional where you'd go, give an order, they'd go chase it, they'd bring it back, they'd give you the piece and so on. They couldn't keep up, so they just took the barriers away and said, go find it yourself. That's how. So really interesting strategies come out of learning process. They don't come from the top or the chief executive necessarily. I mean, that person can be as good a thinker as anybody else. But they don't necessarily come from on high, sort of like Moses coming down with the tablets. They can come from anywhere, anyone who learns. Which means anyone. And the people who are at the base, that's why the people who are at the base, these are the ones who have their teams, and these guys are sitting the way you described it in their little, you know, on their slabs, separate from everybody else. So it's more likely that these guys are going to come out with the ideas than those guys. because they're, after all, dealing with customers every day. McDonald's used to say that all our new product ideas come from the franchisees because they're selling hamburgers all day long. Okay, so this is the main message I want to convey about strategy. And let me just show you some of the PowerPoints. So strategy is plan, strategy is pattern. Strategy looking forward, strategy looking backward. Okay, and this is the diagram I just did, where you have deliberate strategy processes, emergent strategy processes, and strategies that just don't get realized at all. And you have all these PowerPoints. Okay, and then I want to introduce two more definitions of strategy. And I'm going to do it, yeah.
You just explained us that strategy is a learning process. I would like to transfer this into the real world, into a big corporation. We do have departments, big departments, very well paid, yeah. all the colleagues there, yeah. who work on strategies. Yeah. How can they learn in a big company like mine, for example?
Well, you know, often it's kind of what's called skunk works. People in a corner who are sort of defying authority and trying something new without asking permission, all sorts of things. But look, most of what happens, whether it's an airline or a telecom company or almost anything else, is not about strategy. It's about operations. You know, I don't fly Lufthansa because it has wonderful strategies. I fly Lufthansa because it tends to be on time. It's comfortable. They know what they're doing and so on. And KLM just lost my luggage, or Alitalia just lost my luggage for 12 days. So, you know, that's how we make our choices. I don't say Lufthansa has a wonderful strategy, although it may have a wonderful strategy. But so most of the things are about operations. Strategy is about learning your way into new ideas, new things.
So for the customer, strategy is not so important.
What's that?
So for the customer, client, the strategy of a company is not so important.
Well, yeah, exactly. But it may be important if it opens me up to new things. In IKEA, the strategy is very important because if I go to another furniture store, I'm not going to get that nice design. I'm not going to get the P thing in my car. You know, I don't get all the advantages that are part of their strategy. Whereas in the airline business, strategies are quite common. This is not to be insulting at all, but you know, flying on Lufthansa is not hugely different from flying on Air Canada, which is a partner. There are differences, and the food might be better in one or whatever, but essentially it's a common experience. What I find amusing about the airline industry, which I think is never fails to amuse me, is that you haven't done it, Lufthansa hasn't done it, but a lot of the big airlines, when they created discount airlines, they used cutesy names for them. So TED for United, or Jazz, what are they calling it, Jazz, or the other thing they call it in Air Canada, or my favorite one is Baby. British Midland calls it Baby. Can you imagine if you're the vice president in charge of Baby sitting in a room with all the other vice presidents and you're supposed to defend Baby? And what it suggests is they don't take it seriously. It's like the discount, this isn't real. And they announce it to the world by these idiotic names for it. It's really quite funny. So that's sort of revealing what's behind their thinking. Anyway, so two other definitions, and I'm going to do it by asking you about Egg McMuffin. Has anybody ever had the displeasure of eating an Egg McMuffin? It's a McDonald's breakfast, basically. Basically, McDonald's introduced Egg McMuffin to bring people in at breakfast time because hamburgers were a lunch or a dinner thing. Was Egg McMuffin a strategic change for McDonald's? How many people say yes, it was a strategic change for McDonald's? Okay, two, three. How many say no? 2-1. All right, why yes?
Because they didn't...
The mic here.
Okay. As you said, they were covering the lunchtime, but they didn't have any product for the breakfast. So they tried to find something to attract people at that time.
Yeah, new product, new market,
right?
New strategy.
Why? Who said no? Why?
My feeling is that they just built on their core competencies. It was nothing new. They just brought in somebody at a different time and offered them a different product. So
same old stuff.
Yes.
Same old stuff, just a bit of variation. Yes. You're both right, or you're both wrong, depending on... You're both right, depending on how you define strategy. If you define strategy as position, the way Michael Porter does, that's sort of tangible, then that position, that comment is correct, because it's a new position. If you define strategy as perspective, your theory of the business, your worldview, broader view, then you say no. And Michael Porter is the best-known strategy guy, and he says position. But the interesting thing is to look at those two in combination. So you have strategy as perspective, new or old, and you have strategy as position, new or old. So a Big Mac on whole wheat bread, nobody in this room would say that's a new strategy. Same position, same perspective. Egg McMuffin, new position, old perspective. Exactly what you two guys said. Okay, cheeseburger served at the table would be a new perspective, but the old position, same product, new way of delivering it. And McDuckling à l'orange, don't hold your breath, would be a new position and a new perspective. Okay, the interesting thing about this is that it's very easy to change position. You can imagine it wasn't a wrenching decision for McDonald's to introduce Egg McMuffin. They had to learn about eggs and bacon and things, but you know, didn't sort of drive them crazy. This kind of thing, or even this kind of thing, could be really wrenching. The established airlines trying to deal with discount airlines is exactly I don't know if you call it a new or old position. I guess it's kind of a new position, but it's certainly a new perspective. You couldn't use the old way of running an airline to do what Ryanair or Southwest or whoever it is was doing. You had to kind of rethink your business. Okay? And that's really interesting in terms of... Can you think of other examples? Think of an example. This is the box that's really interesting. Can you think of an example where a company or an industry had to change its whole way of doing business just to keep the same customers in the same markets? Amazon. Competing with Amazon. You were a bookseller. And the very same books. I buy exactly the same books I buy on Amazon that I would buy in a bookstore. Exactly the same situation. But if I'm a bookstore and Amazon comes along and I'm losing tons of business and I have to start competing with Amazon, I have to change my whole view. If I'm making watches that are movement watches in Switzerland and suddenly, you know... The course watches come along. I have to change my whole philosophy of business, even though, you know, you look at this, you can't tell. You can only tell because I have a thing there, but it looks like a regular watch. In fact, you can still buy, I guess, in Switzerland, they're still making movement watches. So it looks the same, but it's completely different in philosophy. And if you take a look at these four definitions of strategy, then you have four ways of thinking about how to make strategy. Okay? If you're looking at position or perspective and plan, deliberate plan or emergent pattern, okay, then this is planning. Planning is about being deliberate about tangible positions. So McDonald's could do all kinds of planning around Egg McMuffin. That is easy. Okay? Visioning says the strategy is deliberate, but it's about a broad perspective. So it's how do you create a new strategic vision? Okay? A vision is deliberate because it gives some sense of where you're going, but it's very broad. Whereas planning tends to be more about tangible. Should we move out of this market? Should we expand in Asia? Should we contract in South America? Whatever it is. It's pretty, okay. And venturing is about letting 1,000 flowers bloom. It's about strategy is just letting all kinds of things happen, all kinds of positions, and all emergent. Anybody think of a company that does tons of this as a core of its strategy?
Google?
Yeah, Google to some extent. Yeah. Anybody else? 3M. 3M would be the classic, eh? Just all kinds of products all over the place. And 3M is not like, doesn't... Hewlett-Packard has always been kind of struggling, it seems to me, between venturing and this. You know, to the extent that every few years it consolidates, you know, and then it lets things go again. It's sort of like an accordion. They open up new ideas, then they consolidate. You know, basically we've got too many products. We're not calling on our customers in any concerted way. We've got different salespeople calling. So we consolidate, not enough innovation, then we open up again. Right now, HP has become, not exclusively, but significantly, a company that's an inkjet, or at least not inkjet, but a company that's a printer company, much more focused. But 3M remains, I guess, letting a thousand flowers bloom. And then strategy is a learning process where you're learning your way into a new vision. And you could argue this is the doing first, right? This is seeing first. This is thinking first. And this is also doing first. This is only doing, not doing first, but only doing. And the way strategies grow in organizations is they'll typically start there. Okay? They'll start by people just try different things. See, that's how coaching ourselves got going. It's kind of like, we don't know how this is going to work or what we have to do. So we get a customer, we service them, we see what we can do. We try and develop topics. We don't know what topics we're doing. We kind of learn our way into absolutely everything. If you start with too much of this, because entrepreneurial companies are usually breaking new ground. They're not copying what other people are doing. They're not going into the center of an industry. They're going into niche positions or creating new positions, you know. So IKEA, very, very much venturing, trying to figure out how to do it. Once they figure out how to do it, they can do more planning. Okay, or they can learn their way into a new vision. They did both. Okay, so you tend to start here, and then you try and move through this. You move into these positions. When you're a big established company, not doing maybe very innovative things, but serving your customers, you're largely here. I wouldn't fly in an airplane that didn't do tons of operational planning. Not strategic planning, operational planning. Because if Lufthansa didn't do operational planning, the pilots wouldn't get there at the right time, the food wouldn't be on the plane. I mean, enormously complicated planning process for operations, enormously. But the good airlines do it well. So the planes leave on time, they leave with the right food, you know, the staff is there, everything is coordinated. That's the airline business, basically. Okay?
I think at the end of the day, all these companies, more or less, they have all of them mixed.
Yeah. You've got to do all of that. The question is how much of each you do. Professional organizations, we'll talk about that next on Monday, on Sunday. Professional organizations do a lot of this. McGill is, and hospitals are all about venturing, new services, new patients, new ways of doing things. Okay, so they're very much around this. Large established organizations, mass production, mass service, largely about that. But if they don't do some of this, they never change. Same thing here. You need a vision. But entrepreneurial companies really need vision. They need, because they have to position themselves vis-a-vis competitors who are already established, usually. Okay. So if you combine these things with art, craft, science, you get kind of visioning as art, you get planning as science, and you get both venturing and learning as craft, in a way. And vision is deliberately emergent. The reason I show it as an umbrella is because the vision is kind of broad. A plan is very specific. You don't have much choice. A vision is kind of broad, and it basically says under the vision, under the umbrella, you can do a lot of experimenting. So the vision is deliberate, and the learning in terms of venturing takes place within the vision. Vision gives you much more flexibility to try things. Planning doesn't give you that flexibility typically. Okay? And venturing is about letting a thousand flowers bloom. It's It's about trying all kinds of things, okay? And then, what's the timing like, Carl? I guess I should...
Under 5 minutes.
Okay. So, yeah, I won't take too long. So just some words on the planning model. Michael Porter said, I favor a set of analytical techniques for developing strategy. I maintain that nobody in the history of the earth has ever developed strategy through an analytical technique, because strategy is about synthesis, it's not about analysis. You can use analysis to feed in, but strategies are about synthesis. They're about combining things. This is the most famous book on strategic planning ever written. So we're going to take about the next 3 days to go through this. You don't develop strategy that way. So just the planning model. Strategies are created in a fully conscious process of controlled thought. This takes place in clear steps, supported by techniques. The CEO is the chief architect of strategy. Strategies come out of the process immaculately conceived and fully explicit to be implemented. That's the planning version, and I don't think it works very often because of problems of prediction. Where's the thing here? Because of problems of prediction, because of problems of the detachment of the top from the rest, because it's over-formalized. A long-range weather forecast should be obtained before leaving, as weather conditions are extremely unpredictable. Right? This is my favorite quote of all time. This is a researcher in the British Foreign Office in those years, and he said, year after year, the worriers and fretters would come to me with awful predictions of the outbreak of war. I denied it each time. I was only wrong twice. In other words, twice is too much. So prediction is the problem. Not that you can never predict, but you can't. So in science as in love, too much concentration on technique can often lead to impotence. That's the problem with strategic planning. Okay, and the visionary model, I like this. Sometimes I feel like a rhinoceros who doesn't see well and whose power of concentration is terrible. He charges at something that's a long way off, then forgets where he's going and stops to eat grass. This is the problem with a company without vision. So, strategies are created in a semi-conscious process. Deep experience and creative insight enable the visionary to form a vision, a perspective. That vision serves as an umbrella under which specific decisions can be taken and detailed strategies can emerge. And the vision must be kept informal and personal to allow terrain rich and flexible. So it's a very different model. And then the venturing and learning models, this is fun. Ready, fire, aim. It came out of a book, Peters and Waterman, In Search of Excellence. Makes a lot of sense. It actually makes sense because ready, aim, fire implies that you aim once and then you fire and that's it. But what really happens is ready, fire, aim, fire, aim, fire, aim. So you aim before you fire, but you fire before you aim. In other words, you think first to do, and you do first to think. So strategy is this iterative process where you're thinking and doing and thinking and doing. You're getting ideas, you're trying them. They work, some work, some don't. You keep the ones that work, you get rid of the ones that don't. And the thinking first and the doing first, as well as the seeing first, are all intercombined. They're all interconnected. You don't do one or the other. Planning sometimes is really ready, aim, aim. You never quite fire. This is an action plan, you know, which is an oxymoron. You know, either you have action or you have plans. Entrepreneurs are very often fire, fire, fire. They're kind of Rambo style, just keep firing, and so on. So, strategies come out of a process of learning, only partially under the control of conscious thought. Informed individuals anywhere in the organization can contribute. Strategies emerge informally, sometimes gradually, sometimes spontaneously, in a kind of collective process, everybody working together. Formulation and implementation can be so intertwined that it makes no sense to distinguish them. Now, as I said before, this is wrong. This is wrong. Okay? This is wrong. This is wrong. Because it's only all combined that it's right. And that's exactly what you're pointing to, that it's the combination of these things that makes them right. Sorry for this. I like this. We are more likely to act our way into a new way of thinking than to think our way into a new way of acting. Okay, so I'll skip this. This is sort of an extreme, but let me just put these two extremes out. The grassroots view is that strategies grow initially like weeds in a garden. They're not cultivated like tomatoes in a hothouse. Okay? They can take root wherever people have the capacity to learn, like that guy with the table, and resources to support it. They become strategies when the behavior is spread through the organization, and that may be spontaneous or carefully or consciously managed. There's a time to sow strategies and a time to reap them. To manage this process is not the preconceived strategies, but to recognize their emergence and intervene when appropriate. And the opposite model is the hothouse model. There's only one strategist, the chief executive. That person formulates strategy through a conscious controlled process of thought, much as tomatoes are cultivated in a hothouse. These strategies come out of the process fully developed, formally explicit, much as ripe tomatoes are picked and sent to market. And these explicit strategies are then formally implemented. To manage this process is to analyze the appropriate data, preconceive insightful strategies, and then plant them carefully, caring for them and watching over them as they grow on schedule. Reality is somewhere between this and this. Okay? Probably closer to this for creative strategies, but with elements of that. So let me stop there. Just to finish up, the cycle, as I talked about earlier, is you start with venturing. That leads to some kind of vision. The vision enables you to make plans, operating plans, and also to do more venturing. That venturing may lead to the change in vision and so on. So you're going all around the triangle between these models. Okay? Questions? Quick questions, and then we'll turn it over to Carl. I don't know if there are questions there. Probably not, eh? So over to Carl, and he'll sort of carry on with some very interesting. Further, you have one? Okay.
Sure. If you'd like to ask questions from the groups over in other parts of the world, please email them to Leslie.
No, they click on the question mark.
Oh, just click on the question mark. You can ask questions that way. So let me just flip over here. You have my slides as well. So what I want to talk a little bit about, in fact, I might be slightly more radical than Henry in a sense, that we're moving more and away from the deliberate strategy of thought to more emergent, I think more wholesalely, partly because the world's gone nuts. So it's something the world just substantially different today than 10 years ago. I remember 1980, I found it the other day. I had a 20-year plan. I worked at IBM. So I started in 1980, and I found the other day it was 1980 through to the year 2000. What I had was my age, which obviously tracked closely to the year it was. I had how many dollars I'd be making in 1980 dollars. I'd be having what city I'd live in and what job I would have. So I had a 20-year plan, and I gave it to my boss, John Denemy. And John, who was a good manager, he said, "It's a bit ambitious, but we have confidence in you," patted me on the head and sent me on my way. So that was a 20-year plan, which back in that day made sense. Today, when I tell that story at IBM, they roar with the laughter at the sheer foolishness, and they point out the communists couldn't deliver on 5-year plans, let alone 20-year plans. So this is kind of the world that was back then, and one of the key ideas that came from that world was Porter's Five Forces model. Does anybody know what the Five Forces are? It's a famous model, and Michael Porter from Harvard, who's a great guy in many ways, but just saying these ideas of age now and are less relevant. So what we have is the power of suppliers. What he's saying is when you look at an industry, analyzing industry, there's five key forces you want to consider. Suppliers, buyers, substitutes, entrants, new entrants coming into it, and rivalry within the industry itself. So this is the five forces model, and it's useful. We still use it somewhat, but part of the problem today is what is an industry is less clear than it used to be. If you think about the iPad, what industry does it compete in? Well, three or four different ones. High tech maybe is more that way than other ones. What we see is that what the theory here is, it's interesting, Porter studied economics at Harvard for his PhD, and he studied industrial economics. The point of industrial economics was the viewpoint of the government that said monopolies are bad, from the viewpoint of the government. He turned it on its head and said, actually, if you're a company, there's nothing like a good monopoly to make money. So what he said is, if you want to make lots of money, what you need to do is you want to have few entrants into an industry. So what you have here is a pool of profit that you share with your competitors. So what you want is to have high barriers to entry so few people will enter into that industry. So you want to have high barriers to entry. You also want low barriers to exit, so when times are tough, it's easy to leave. So an example of a high barrier to entry is Alcan, the big aluminum company across the street here. It takes about $2 billion to build a new aluminum plant. You don't do that lightly, and once you built it, you don't turn it to use it to make furniture. So there's barriers to exit, right? So that's both makes it ugly in a bad times, but attractive in good times. What you want is have low power of suppliers, so you can tell your suppliers what to do. So Walmart famously, what they do is you fly down to Fayetteville, Arkansas, to negotiate Walmart, very Spartan article offices, and they say to you, we want the lowest price in the industry for your particular area. And that's what they'll get from you. And the positive is we're going to give you the mother of all deals. The largest deal of your career is today. Focus is the mind. I've had a number of people tell me that when Walmart visits your office and you serve them coffee, at the end the senior Walmart person pulls out their wallet and gives you $20 to pay for the coffee. They're not going to owe you anything. It's all about price. Does that make sense? So what you want is to have very low power of suppliers, low power of buyers. So buyers can't tell you what to do. Right? So Coke, do any of you drink Coke? But if you write an angry letter to the CEO of Coke and say, dear sir, ma'am, I'm really ticked off, I'm never buying your product again, you get a phone call from the CEO. They probably don't care. Now, if you're the CEO of Walmart and write that letter, you have someone on a plane the next morning to see you. So what you want is low power suppliers, low power buyers, and you want no substitutes. That is, when prices go up, which we like in a good monopoly, right? What we want then is that I can't substitute. Oil is a good, bad example of that. So we have dirty oil here in Canada from the tar sands. That's what Hillary Clinton called it last week. She said America's going to work with Canada with our dirty oil because Canadians will never invade the U.S. It's interesting. We have a mall in Edmonton, a big city, where they have five submarines in the mall. That is more than the Canadian Navy, to give you a sense of the sharp edge of the Canadian Navy. So Americans love us because we argue with Americans, but they're our closest neighbors and we're good neighbors. So it's better than Middle Eastern oil. Does that make sense? So you're saying oil is great because there's few substitutes. Now, we're madly working as a world on windmills and other substitutes, but not with great success. Then rivalry is you don't want to have very... What you'd love to have is that, okay, you guys have Germany, and we'll take Japan and Korea, and we won't bug you over there. So you kind of separate the world into different spheres. So what Porter's saying is that what you do is you analyze these five forces in an industry, and then you decide your strategy. And there's some appeal to this. It's interesting, about 10 years later, Porter writes another big book. I mean, it's literally a big book called The Competitive Advantage of Nations. And what he says is the exact opposite about competition. What he said is, actually, if you want to be a global competitor, you don't want a monopoly because you get fat and lazy. There's nothing like brutal competition to be a good global player. What it is let's say ice hockey. I played ice hockey last night. Okay, we won 5-1, so we're particularly pleased. It was 10:30 to 11:30, so by the time I got home after rigorous exercise, I didn't fall asleep till about 2. That's the downside of it. But Canadians love ice hockey. So if you want to check out new skates and new sticks, Canada is a great place to do it because we have enormous competition, enormous interest, right? You don't want to check out and try out new skates in, let's say, Japan. Japan's not big into ice hockey, is it? Or Kenya. Great, even better example, perhaps. Do you have an ice rink in Kenya?
One.
I remember once I was in Durban and I went skating in an ice rink, and, you know, I'm not a very good skater, but compared to the average South African, they literally parted and watched me skate and applauded at the end. But, you know, I'm just an average Canadian person, but there it was a big deal. So what Porter said 10 years later is what you want is to have hugely demanding suppliers, hugely demanding customers, hugely demanding competitors, because that sharpens your edge. That makes you a great competitor. So there's nothing worse from you than a monopoly. Does that make sense? Do you see the logic of that? See, this is a model we still teach on the MBA. And I wanted to kind of share it with you today. Some of you have ran into it before. But saying is, it's getting long in the tooth, not because Porter's not a great person, but because the world's gone on. Yeah. Oh, do you have the microphone?
You're saying you're teaching the last one or the first one?
We teach both.
Or both.
So we actually teach the five forces model in the MBA, and we teach the national diamond, which is the second idea. He has other ideas, but that's one. We teach both. And they're somewhat useful, but they're getting frayed. The world is a little bit different now. Okay? So what Henry is saying is that there's still a place for deliberate strategy, but the world's moved on to emergent because of the nature of the economy. That's fine? Okay. So let me... this is some of the things that you know well because you're out there in the world. What we see is a very different world. So we have the rise of the BRIC countries, right? I teach a course in globalization here. First started 15 years ago teaching it in England. And 10 years ago, we barely mentioned India or China on a course in globalization. Today, if I did that, they would wonder where I've been. What cave have I been living in? But it wasn't that 15 years ago I was wrong or ignorant. Well, I was wrong, maybe slightly ignorant, but I wasn't that far off. The world is a different place. That India and China were just not as important to the outside. Okay? Today we recognize their importance. We have the economic meltdown. So the things we taught you 3 years ago in the boom days, you remember the boom days? Those are some of the best years of our life. Looking back now, it's kind of sad to think of that, but they were great times, but the strategies we had then are very different today. We have things like the new media, and we'll talk about, Dimitrios will talk about that on Friday. We have climate change. I don't know where where your countries or you sit on this, but my students now essentially agree that climate change is a fact, young people. That 5 years ago, there was debate in the classroom here. Today, young people, and they may be wrong, they are young and foolish at times, believe that, you know, when you look at the growth, my grandparents moved here from Finland. They had my Aunt Martha in their arms. They left Finland, moved to northern Ontario, and lived in a cabin with no, they had fireplace to heat, no electricity, candles for lighting. Okay? My mother tells a story of skiing to school 12 miles. See, with the occasion I was complaining I had to walk to school. And so maybe your mother or father did this. She said, well, when I was a kid, I had to ski 12 miles each way to school and occasionally scare off brown bears. So stop whining. So I said, I'm not sure I believed her, but my aunts and uncles supported her, that she had to ski at times and scare off bears. So that was, you know, the life. And my Irish grandparents moved to the prairies and lived in a grass hut, except for it's cold. It's like 40 below. So our grass huts were this thick, the walls were cut out of the land. And it was incredible. And so when you look at it, our grandparents, tough times, my parents did better. My brother and I have done better, but my students assume it's going to turn down, that their homes will be smaller. They'll have, well, I have a beat-up old car, so it's going to be hard to get worse, but they're not going to have two BMWs. They might have one or half. I'm sure you have a half, but sharing or something. But they assume the world is going to be less abundant because of climate change. I don't know, does that make sense to yourselves? Depends on what country and where you are, but that's, you know, McGill students view that as the way it is. We'll see. And Japan is already seeing a bit of that in terms of the economy and turning down. So we see is that that's happening out there. We have Wikinomics and the idea. I remember when I was 10 years old, I had the flu, so I got down Britannica Encyclopedia, and I read the first volume, the first article, because I was an organized child. So I read the one on aardvarks, because it starts with two A's in English. So they had a good PR agent, okay? And it was an article written by a full professor of zoology at Harvard, and it was the definitive article on aardvarks. Today, with Eric and Mariev at the table, let's say we talk about geckos. What do we do to find out about geckos? Do we go to the encyclopedia? No, we get the app. Well, the apple's already at the dinner table, and we Google geckos, and we go to Wikipedia. Who wrote the article on Wikipedia? Well, it could be anybody. They have geckos in Hawaii, so a little 10-year-old might have gone out, picked up a gecko, and said, yeah, they have tails. Why? Because I have a gecko with a tail. She writes in, geckos have tails. Now, it may be the very rare that geckos have tail. Maybe they're largely tailless. But that would be changed very rapidly. So we look at knowledge as much more diffuse than before. And this gets to Henry's idea of, does the CEO deliver this beautiful, immaculate strategy? You go, there you are. Well, maybe if you're an entrepreneur, you do. But the idea of only the man or woman at the top has knowledge and wisdom, young people just don't get that. Because of Wikipedia, because of the technologies, they don't think it's only the people at the top, the people with gray or no hair, that have wisdom. You and I might have grown up with that view. So the nice part is that strategy comes from all of you, not just the person at the top, is the emerging view. Okay? So what we see is a world that's gone nuts and very different than in the past. Therefore, some of the old approaches have got to go away. Moore's Law is no relation to myself, unfortunately. Gordon Moore, co-founder of Intel, and he says that technology doubles every 18 months. Anybody want my 486? What's a 486 good for? A boat anchor, you know, a small boat. So what we're looking at is that this technology continues to change things dramatically. Another underlying force. Medcalf's Law, I don't know if you've heard of that, it's one of the two laws of today's economy. Medcalf's Law says that in some products, the value of a product idea goes up exponentially with the number of users. How much would you pay for the only fax machine in the world? Nothing. Why? Yeah, there's got to be one on the other end, right? So fax machine goes up as more have them. How about email? Do you know anyone who doesn't have an email? Do you? My yoga coach doesn't have an email. But when you meet someone, it kind of stops the conversation, doesn't it? I'll send you an email. I don't have one. You go, oh. It's the Queen of England. That's all right. We accept it. It's all right. Who? Can I ask who doesn't have an email? Okay. Yeah, my mother doesn't. I don't know how they talk to each other, but my mother doesn't have one either. Is it your mother? It's an aunt. Okay. So I guess that generation, but... You know, when you run into a younger person doesn't have email, it just stops. It's like having a homeless person. You go, well, okay, I mean, fine. But you kind of, don't you wonder about them slightly? But we'll leave them alone. So what it is with social media is that increasingly we want to harness this idea of the bigger the network, the more valuable it is. So that's an idea that again, is pushing change out there. So... one other final thing. This is a business school view of all of human history. Okay, so we're going to explain human history here. And seriously, this is kind of Quebec's history where we are. Quebec is here largely because French people wanted to come over and get beaver pellets and send them back to Paris and London. If you look at it, McGill, I think, was a fur trader. McGill University is named after him. And you go to, we'll be at the faculty lunch, it's Sugar Baron's house, former. Oh, beaver pelts is, I'm trying to explain this in a way which is politically correct. You get a beaver and it dies, preferably committed suicide. And then you take the fur off. Did I say that without offending anyone? It's a fur, then you make a hat out of it. You remember at the Buckingham Palace, the soldiers? They have fur hats. Those are a beaver, traditionally. They're traditionally. Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, are they bear? Well, they are. So, thing that's the, yeah. So what happened is we got started by extracting commodities, and that's why Canada was populated to some degree. My Irish grandparents lived on the prairies. My Uncle Jack had 50,000 acre farm. One man and a tractor and 50,000 acres. But what it is a tractor, it's air conditioned, and you get in the tractor and a half hour later you turn around and come back. And it's very flat, and so you just sit there and a half hour later you go, oh yeah, I got to turn around. And so it's easy to do. From an Indian viewpoint, I think 50,000 acres is an astonishing farm, maybe. It depends the kind of farming you do. Okay. Then we moved after World War II, we made goods. So what happened is that we went from making swords to making plowshares. So U.S. and Canada particularly, all our competitors were in ashes to some degree, Europe and so on, Japan. So what we did is we went from making all these war things to making peace. We had the baby boom and great growth. So we had a lot of manufacturing. What has happened to that? We've outsourced a lot of that to China, the manufacturing bit. Now, what we see, the economy in U.S. and Canada is about 84-85% is services. So we've seen evolution here of the economy. And then what we have now is the experience economy increasingly. And on the edge of the experience economy is the transformational economy. So what it is that the transformational economy is, I want to not just have dinner, but I want to have an experience that makes me slightly better, human being. When I was a kid, we used to go to the cottage. So there was a small home, you know, up in the north. And you'd go there with your mother for 6 weeks every summer. No longer do we go to Europe now, or we go to Latin America or Asia as an experience. Because we're looking, as we get wealthier, we want more experiences. So this is more of a problem of a wealthier society, the transformational economy. There's a restaurant on Sherbrooke called Au Noir. What it is, it's a restaurant where it's totally dark. There's no light. And I don't know if anyone's been to one of these. But you go in there, and all the servers are blind. The servers are blind, and you eat in the total dark. What it was is a Swiss pastor wanted his members of his church to be more concerned about people that are blind. So he said, well, we'll make you blind for an evening. And I went once, and once is sufficient. Because you're sitting there, it's totally dark, and, you know, maybe Ricardo's there and he takes my drink without me, not that Ricardo would do that, but knowing he takes and sips my drink. And then I might eat a steak by mistake because it's totally dark. And what happens is everybody talks much louder. Because as you lose your vision, you talk louder. It's like what Canadians do when we're in foreign countries. We speak English louder, assuming that they will understand if we speak loud enough. Which is not helpful generally, but we feel better. Okay? So that's an experience where you're being transformed. So what we see is an evolution of the North American, European, Japanese, Korean economies over the last 20 years. Now, we still have commodities, oil, natural gas. We still manufacture somewhat, but we look at a huge shift, which means that what your organization's going to do to make money is changing substantially. Okay? So what you see is a lot of things going on. Now, I'll just skip over this in the interest of time. This is an airline. Does anyone buy their air ticket to come here from a travel agent? Did anybody use a travel agent? One? Why did you use a travel agent? Okay. Well, most of us, I think, would go online, and probably your secretary went online, but most of us go online now. So what has happened is that industry has died out to a large degree, travel agents. There's one right over here, though, on Sherbrooke, and they are for Australia. They're all Australians. And you go in there, they go, how's it going, mate? Things like that. And they're all named Bruce. Anyway, you go there. There's a famous Monty Python skit about Bruce you should watch. But you go there, and they, if you want to go to Australia, they absolutely understand Australia. But I would not go to a travel agent normally. So what has happened is dramatically changed that industry. Look at another industry, one is Cirque du Soleil. You'll be visiting, some of you will be visiting the next week. So Guy Laliberté said, without changing, he changed what a circus is dramatically. He said, "It's not." Have you heard the expression, it's a three-ring circus? It's an expression you might hear in business, it's a three-ring circus, which is the old view of what a circus was. He made one ring, which saves a lot of money. He got rid of the animals, which today animal rights would agree with, but back then it was about the cost of an elephant is high. So what he did was, and he also, he doesn't do it in any language spoken by humanity. It's not, and it's a very Quebec solution, not French, not English. We'll do it in gibberish. The great news, when I go to Japan, the Japanese don't know what they're talking about either. But that's all right, we don't either, back home. He's reinvented the circus and has made a fortune. He's a billionaire now. So something where he's reinvented it very dramatically, but it wasn't about, he didn't add anything. He just reinvented, rethought about how it is. Okay. Now, what I want to give you is an idea here. I want to give you two ideas this morning and into this afternoon. One is called The Innovator's Dilemma, and it's by a professor at Harvard called Clay Christensen. Okay? I'll show you the idea, and it's evolved since, and I've done a bit of work with the written article of the CEO of his consulting company. So it's evolved a bit. Have you heard of the innovator's dilemma? Has anyone ran into that? One or two of you? One has? Okay. Well, Peter, jump in as you can then. So what we teach you in business school downstairs is we teach you to listen to your customers. That's called the marketing course, right? Listen, we invest aggressively in new technologies because we love new technologies, right? We provide more and better products to customers. We study market trends, and we invest in innovations that promise the best return. That's the financial people say that. We need a good ROI, NPV, IRR, EIEIO. That's what we're looking for there, okay, is that sort of thing. What Clay is arguing is that actually that sometimes will get you into deep trouble if you follow that advice, okay? So in examples, IBM dominated the mainframe, and this is one that I was involved, I worked for IBM, it wasn't my fault, but I worked there. We missed the mini computer. DEC come along and dominates mini computer. Do any of you remember minis? Are you old enough? My 20-year-olds don't remember this at all, but mini computers. So it's reassuring. So DEC came along, and look at, here's what Forbes said about DEC. Taking on DEC these days is like standing in front of a moving train. Not good things to do. And I remember DEC offering me a job, and it was very intriguing to go to DEC because they were the dominant player. What happened to DEC? Anybody remember? DEC got bought by Compaq, who got bought by HP. Back then, it was embarrassing to work for HP. It was a stodgy old firm. It was embarrassing. And in Canada, HP meant a steak sauce, not Hewlett Packard. So that was embarrassing. But what happened is that DEC got eaten up. Xerox got beat by a relatively small or medium-sized Japanese company. So Canon beat Xerox. So Xerox used to have big machines in the basement. Remember that? And you go, you queue up in the basement, and there'd be a long line in front of you. Remember that? And then the person in front of you would not let you in. And they had 10,000 copies, but they had let in five people, and they had to draw a line in the sand, and you were it. You know, when I explain this to my students, they don't get why you don't have one at home, because we all have them at home now. Because when you buy a fax machine, they throw in a photocopier. So the world, again, is very different. But what happened is Xerox had a strategy, which is large companies, big Hummers, and if you had a long line, what would the sales rep from Xerox say if you had a long line, a long queue in the basement? What was their solution? Buy a second one. You know, the ones where you put trees in one end and it flies out the other end, these big machines? That was their solution. They had a great sales force. They leased it. Best technology. Canon came along and had an inferior technology. It was worse in terms of quality. They went for small companies, decentralized, and they blew Xerox away. Xerox to this day is still trying to find its place in the sun. It's located in Rochester, south of here in New York State. They're still looking for what do we do now. But even today, I think I said yesterday to Sarah, I said, can I get something Xeroxed? That's how powerful a name it was. And I still say that because of the power of the name. So what we have here is some great successful companies, including one I work for. And what happened is that they fell away from success. So what we're saying, sometimes you should not listen to customers. Sometimes you want to go after poor technology with lower margins, and you want to go after small rather than big markets. The problem is the corporate immune system rejects these ideas because marketing goes, well, wait a minute. We want our top customers to like the product. They want big markets and say, they said, what's your analysis? Oh, you guys are to do the analysis. It's that table that doesn't do analysis, so I'll talk to you. So they want to have analysis, but you go, well, we can't provide the analysis. We go to the finance people, and the finance people say, what's the ROI? And we go, it's really low. We go to the engineers, and we go, it's inferior. And they go, well, at engineering school, they teach you that things get better. You never want to step back. So our organizations will reject these ideas. Now, I'll show you a diagram here, and we'll get you to do a workshop in a couple minutes, okay? So I'll stop talking soon. This is simply the product performance over here and the time at the bottom. So what happens is that product performance increases over time, thanks to Moore's Law, big leaps, or engineers improving things, right? Things get better over time. Fair enough? What we have here is our most demanding customers here and our least demanding customers here. We often go to our most demanding customers to say, what do you want in a new product? And that's a good strategy. We teach that in the business school. Now, what happens? There's two problems. One is that we keep improving and we can overshoot what the customers want. And Clay wrote an article for Foreign Quarterly arguing Japan has done this. That Japan can have too much quality sometimes. And partly because I've been to Japan 6 times, I guess. I love the food in Japan. I love the clothing. It's such high quality. But not all countries in the world have that same desire for quality the Japanese embody. Sometimes you want something adequate. You know, it's interesting because they talk about how people, we used to be consistent, that if you lived in a big house, you'd have a nice car and you'd go to certain restaurants, where now people who live in big homes go to Walmart. What we do, we choose categories we buy up and we buy down. So instead of being consistent, we buy up and down. So we decide where we want to spend money and where we want to save money. So sometimes we deliberately want... So in fact, just discuss for 30 seconds with the person beside you. So everybody look to your left. Well, actually, it won't work, will it? So anyway, sort it out. So one category where you buy up and where you buy down. So just discuss that for 1 minute, okay, in groups of two. Well, with 5, it might be hard to do. You may have to have 3. One category you buy up and one where you buy down. So, okay. So things where I have an old car as I walk to work. So we have an old car. I buy down. On the other hand, we like to travel. So my wife and children are going to South Africa for holidays. So we buy up. We're spending more money on holidays, less on a car. So that it's buying up, holidays, buying down in terms of an old beat-up car. Yeah, just saying is that, well, in one area we're not going to worry about it, but another area we want to, so we have a nice house, but an old car. So I like clothes, but I'm not worried about restaurants. So I've got to choose where I save money and where I spend money. Does that make sense? Just think in your life, do you do that the same? Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. One of my former students was hired by Walmart to have luxury bands. Brands. So Walmart was trying to have luxury brands. She worked in Mexico for Givenchy and run it. And they hired her to go, we want luxury at Walmart, which is contrary to what you and I would think.
You should tell them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, they could. So the teams out there in the World Wide Web, please do answer the same question among yourselves, and then you could give Leslie a feedback here by the question mark. So thank you. So so you guys have an example? So so Peter has an example here. Just listen up for a moment. Where he buys up in one category and buys down another.
Mine?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would buy up in a car to have a safer car, maybe more fuel efficient, okay. That type of thing.
Yeah.
And then for clothing, I would never buy like a $200 pair of jeans or pants or whatever. I would just buy like an Old Navy or a Walmart type of.
So because Peter and I have the exact opposite. We have a 97 Chrysler Intrepid. As I walk to work, my wife and I together drive an hour a week. I'd love to have a BMW Mercedes. I'd love to, but I just can't justify it. But given the clothes I'm wearing, this might be a bit, because I'm wearing it for the hike, I like nice suits, okay, which you might argue with in seeing my suits, but we'll leave that alone. So Peter and I, both nice people, have the exact opposite behavior. Does that make sense? And for good reason. Now, he says, well, it's a safer car. And actually, it's a fair point, but still, if you're walking, it's irrelevant. But still, I agree with Peter's viewpoint, but I have the exact opposite view. Okay, how about over here? An example at this table?
I have an example for just buying down. So okay. It's like you mentioned when I buy food. So in the country where I live, it's Germany. Nowadays, it's very common to buy at Aldi. Probably 15 years ago, nobody would have bought at Aldi. Only those people who could not afford, but can spend that much money. But nowadays, quite a lot of people from all kind of levels buy at Aldi.
So it's like Walmart or something like that, is it?
Yes, similar. Yes, but
yeah, it's a supermarket.
But also the reputation of Aldi changed a little bit. So,
as Henry pointed out, that Costco, which the name kind of says it all, Costco, is actually you buy down, but you can also buy up, and it's a better price because of their volume of buying. So what we're saying is that it's hard to understand customers sometimes. And we should go to the top customers, but we don't need to go to quality. That's one problem. The biggest problem, the one that's most interesting, is down here. Okay? This is a disruptive technology or innovation. So what happens is that our products improve over time. A competitor comes out down here, below what even our least demanding customers want. Therefore, our customers reject it as being inferior, bad technology, a bad business model, we don't want it. But what happens over time, it keeps getting better and better and eventually starts eating into here and may take away and create bankruptcy. Okay? So an example would be Southwest Airlines. So Southwest came out and they said, we're going to have one flight a day. We're going to go from second-tier airports to second-tier airports. We're going to have unassigned seating, no business class, no food. So what they did is American Airlines went, and Clay actually checked with that, and went up to their most demanding customers, and they rejected it soundly. There's a famous ad about the same time in Canada about two airlines, Air Canada and Canadian, and the ad was who had the best China. Not the flights to China, but who had the best plates. And they had people, Henry will remember this, people walking across the wing from one plane to the other to get the better China in business class. How the world has changed. Because now it's about who has more flights to China. But that was the competition. So it was rejected by our frequent flyers. It was even rejected by the average person in the back. The market they went after was saying, our competitor is the bus. So it was grandparents and students. Saying if you're going from L.A. to Phoenix, it's about 15 hours on a bus, that's pretty ugly to be 15 hours on a bus. So if you can fly, even though you don't have assigned seating, even though there's only one flight a day, see, if you're a grandparent and you're going to see your three-year-old grandchild, see, in business, if you're in Montreal, you want to be in Toronto as soon as a business opens, right, to impress Toronto people how businesslike you are. And you want to make sure there's lots of flights so that if your meetings are done early, you can come back. But if you have a three-year-old, you don't show up at noon, and a three-year-old granddaughter doesn't go, James, where were you? I was expecting you around 8 this morning. It's a bit lazy to show up at noon. Three-year-olds do not have that conversation. So grandparents don't care that there's only one flight a day. Grandparents don't care that it's a second-tier airport. They're trying to impress a three-year-old. The three-year-old doesn't go, oh, Stan said, not Heathrow. Well, I have to wonder about how serious you are as a business flyer. And students were just happy not to be on a bus for 15 hours. See, if you're on a bus for 15 hours, unassigned seating is less of a problem. But what happened is that the bankers that Southwest went to said, well, show us your plan and show us your surveys of existing customers and their desire to not have assigned seating, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the fact is that grandparents and college students weren't flying. I mean, rich grandparents were, but the average grandparent wasn't. And they couldn't justify it. So it was rejected by our companies because finance didn't like the return. Marketing said, well, we have no data. We had our customers reject it. It was embarrassing. Would you want to be a pilot on this sort of plane? No, because it's just not as exciting. It's not status. But how is Southwest doing these days? Well, Southwest has not only got grandparents and college students, it's got actually a lot of Canadian business people fly on WestJet, which is the Canadian equivalent. I've flown WestJet, I must admit. Do you ever fly a discount airline? Well, okay, maybe I won't ask Lufthansa people, but you have your own. Okay, what's it called? Okay, sure. So Lufthansa has, but how many years did it take for Lufthansa to get to German wings? I shouldn't embarrass our beloved customers here, but it took a while, didn't it? Okay. So, and that's not, Lufthansa is not a bad example at all. Just saying, you know, we can see it in an airline industry, how this came along, but we see it was rejected for good reason. Yet, looking back, we go, what were we thinking? And we can go back and see what they were thinking, and they rejected it for good reason. Okay. Two other examples then. So we have Inkjet and Laserjet from Hewlett-Packard. And do you remember the first Inkjets? They go, and they, you know, kind of gently, you know, and the only thing they were good for was cash register tapes at the supermarket. I don't know about you, but I don't read my cash register tape a second time. Now, maybe you do, and I apologize if I'm offending you. But very few of us pull them out a year later and go, that was a fun trip to the supermarket. I want to look at the tape again and just relive that moment. Now, if you do, I think it's sad, but, you know, we'll leave that judgment to the side, okay? So what happened is that Inkjet kept improving. Where I had my computer stolen about 9 years ago. And it's funny because my neighbor Sam saw someone coming out my back door with my computer. So Sam walks over and says, what are you doing? And the guy says, I think in a moment of real honesty, I'm getting a Christmas gift, which was probably entirely true. So Sam went back home and phoned the police, and it turned out to be a stolen car, which is perhaps not a surprise that they're consistent in their behavior. So I go to the big electronics store and say, I want a new computer, and I want a LaserJet. I was living in the old world. The LaserJet was so much superior. And the young guy goes, well, no, you want an Inkjet. And I said, I don't think you understand me. I'm a man of quality. I want a LaserJet. And he kind of looked sad, and he said, well, actually, let me show you one, and it's actually much better. So what happened is that it's interesting because at HP, they own both of these. The senior executive took Inkjet to the people at Boulder, Colorado, and said, we want you to do Inkjet. And they looked at it, and they said, no, thank you. It's inferior. It's embarrassing. And our engineers refused to work on it but what they did is they went to Washington State, which is, Leslie would know, but it's about 1,000 kilometers or so from Colorado. Well, it's miles. Anyway, it's a long way. I think it's a fair statement. And they hired young engineers from the University of Washington who did not know better. They didn't know they should be embarrassed. And so what happened is they brought in, and the inkjet has taken, grown and taken off huge business from LaserJet. So, you know, I think I have one more example. Are you starting to get this? Is this making sense? Okay. The mini mills. So, might be more of a POSCO example, but mini mills, when they first came out, was so bad quality, they had to bury it in concrete. The quality was so bad. And that's useful because in buildings you have bars in the walls to keep them so they don't fall over. So it's very useful. And down there, steel bars and concrete were small volume, very low profits. So U.S. Steel rejected mini mills because low quality, low margins, low volumes, low margins. But then they got a bit better at it and they could start to do other things you didn't have to bury in concrete. Bigger margins. Now, see, if you can make money at 7, what does 12 look like? If I can make money at 7, what does 12 look like to me? Wonderful. I've died and gone to heaven. Okay? Now, they got even more, got better and better, and now I'm at 18% margins. I don't know what to do with the money. Well, I hired corporate strategy planners and things like that. So what happened is eventually this took over a significant part of steel, and we had people like U.S. Steel in deep financial trouble. Okay. So I'm going to ask you now to apply this model. I had a Skype example. So I remember I was teaching at the Rotterdam School of Management, and some Indian students came to me as a project and said, you should have voice over internet protocol, because they had to phone their mothers back in India, but it was incredibly expensive back then. And it was kind of like CB radio. So you'd phone and say, hi, Mom, I love you, over. And Mom would go, I love you too, son, over. So, you know, but compared to never phoning your mother, this is pretty good. But it was like two tin cans or CB radio. But today, I think I phoned almost all of you on Skype, didn't I? Now, I wonder if TU couldn't do it because of corporate immune systems, and that's fair enough. But by and large, and most of us had video. So I saw some of you in pajamas. So that was quite interesting, but a different time change. But, well, we had Skype now, and we have video. Well, first time we did this, Henry, it was like $1,000 an hour to do video to our friend Jonathan. We had to go to a separate building down the street to bring in Jonathan from England for an hour. Incredibly expensive in a separate building. Today we do that quite trivially. Okay. So what I want to ask you is, has this happened in your industry? And secondly, could this happen? What's on your radar that could make your industry change? So let's look in the past, and I've already given Southwest, so that's an unfair advantage, you guys, but I think you knew that one anyway. Looking forward, what's it out there that could eat your lunch that's out there today? Now, not all of them work out. Some we reject for good reason. They are dumb ideas. But those we're not worried about. So I want you to take about 10 minutes and apply this model to your industry. Do you understand the model then? So most demanding, least demanding customers, our product improving, our competitors improving. We reject it for good reason, but it comes and eats our lunch. Has everybody got that model? Any questions or anything? Henry? Yeah, you're as much as we can by company, but yeah, it's or industry group. Yeah, they are, but it's kind of tough to do because of the variety. Look at your industry and discuss. If there's someone else from the same industry, fine. If not, think about it and then discuss it with one or two other people. Okay. Everybody understand that? And I would like the groups where you are on the web to do the same exercise and let us know some examples that you're having as well. So I'll give you about 15 minutes to do that. And this is where if you need to grab a bathroom break or a coffee break, because we're on live here, we won't take a break. So do the work and get a break in there if you need to. So who are you talking to? And Peter?
Yeah, the thing is we're in totally different...
No, that's for now. But yeah. So think of an example and explain it to those yeah. guys. I'm sure you've seen them.
Yeah.
You know, in spades, so...
You, a colleague and I were having a discussion...
Did anybody have any, I hope someone did, anybody have any examples from their industry they could share with us?
I would like to share one.
Okay, Ricardo.
Okay, now with this energy generation,
yep.
Now with the wind and solar energy.
Microphone.
Talking about utility energy generation, wind energy and solar, sooner or later they're going to take over from the traditional carbon and oil generation.
Okay.
If they concern utilities here, private sector, they have to consider how to generate wind power, solar, something like that. Otherwise, they're going to be out of business.
Okay. So you can see that as a disruptive technology.
Right.
Okay. Other examples? Yep, one over here.
I'm from Panasonic, and we provide a flat panel TV. And as you all know, our product quality of our product is very, very good, and but over quality for now. So
okay.
On the other hand, Samsung or LG 5 years ago, they provide good design and good price product into the U.S. market.
Yeah.
And now, completely, they are giant. And currently, another from Chinese, Vizio or very, very low price product in the market, especially Walmart or such kind of retail shop,
yep.
They are selling very, very cheap price flat TV.
Okay. Yes. So they're So we see here is examples where it can be either too much quality, over-specified, or it can happen down here. Now, this doesn't happen that often. So this is not something that's going to happen for sure in your industry. But it has happened often enough, it should make us nervous. And we need to keep an eye, particularly big companies who have systems that are going to reject this sort of thing. But it doesn't happen all the time. There's a couple other interesting ideas about innovation here. One is that when you have a business model, it's hard for that same set of people, that same organization, to change to a different approach to business. Maybe, Klaus, you're saying that this is German Wings is quite different than Lufthansa in that way? Why is that? Can you have the mic, please?
German Wings is a low-cost carrier of Lufthansa, and the business model is completely different. And within what are you doing, Ricardo? And within Lufthansa people are proud to manage complexity. And for a low-cost carrier, they hate complexity. So you need different managers and different people to run these models, and that's why Lufthansa created German Wings with new managers, new people, and now they are looking if it's working or not. And the next step could be that German Wings will take the destinations within Germany from A to B, from Hamburg to Berlin, from Hamburg to Frankfurt, instead of Lufthansa. So they are thinking of doing that because the low-cost carrier business model runs fine.
Yeah? And so Lufthansa be for the long haul. Because if I'm flying Frankfurt to Tokyo, I can justify business class. Because I'm negotiating a $2 million deal, it's worth a few $1,000s if I'm better rested. It's hard to argue that between Hamburg and Berlin. Just because it's just a shorter flight, it's harder to justify that. But it's interesting that it's often a different business unit because how we view the world is different. Because if you're looking at low-cost carrier, it's quick turnarounds, it's about everybody helps, that no one is too proud, but you're not going to expect an A380 captain to be out there, you know, cleaning. Maybe he or she should, but that's a different expectation. So it's hard when you have a culture to have a second culture in the same organization. Now, I guess LG does in some degrees. There's different cultures, but then you have separate companies. Okay? See, one of the biggest needs in the world today is innovation in most companies. Innovation is a critical issue. So one of the, I just want to have a couple ideas here on innovation. I'll show you a second model. Is this is some research I did in the 80s, or in the 90s, late 90s, and saying the theoretical main advantage, biggest advantage of being a global firm like LG or Panasonic is that you have multiple places to learn innovation. Now, that's the theory, but in practice, we fall short. So when you look at it, where does knowledge come from? Knowledge in some companies, in Japan, traditionally has been like this, where the work is done in Tokyo and our subsidiaries salute and deliver that to the local market. Don't change it. Another model, and this is the European model traditionally, is that knowledge about local culture is really important, and it keeps there, and we change our product, and each of these is a king or queen. Okay? Partly it used to be that, and it goes back to at one time in the British colonies, they'd send a young man from Oxford or Cambridge to run all of northern Canada. And they were 22 years old. There was no way they could communicate, and so what he did was what the Queen would do. So you say, as a good Englishman, what would the Queen do? And do that. And we trusted that his culture would be sufficient to do the right thing. So that's more the European view, is kind of culture matters, and we'll let the person there judge. Another model, and this is again what we're saying in a global firm, is that we learn here and here and here. And so we exchange knowledge between subsidiaries, between head office and the subsidiaries, and there's learning all over the place. If we're looking for more innovation, we need to look for learning, which is Henry was talking about that, right? We need more learning. Therefore, we need to be more humble and recognize there's learning out here. Then we talk about centers of excellence. So that was what the article is about. When we first published this, Julian, a friend of mine who's at London Business School, we said, this is an evolution. So this is, you know, it's in the slime, it climbs onto the land, it grows legs, and finally we have a McGill alumni. You know, kind of the peak of human evolution. But we recognize that actually, this might be all right, each of these depending on the context. Okay? So if local culture is more important than a global product, then culture should be queen. Sometimes there's products like an iPad is an iPad. Now, we have in the Japanese language or the Korean language, as we should, but it's still an iPad. And if you brought in an iPad, I would recognize it. I might not be able to read it. But in fact, I've been in Japan and used Microsoft in Japanese because I knew if you go down four, it's edit. And I was, it was a long, frustrating process, but I could use Japanese Microsoft as I knew the format so well. And I could edit in English using Japanese, but it was much more difficult. So sometimes there's global products. But I think the overall world is saying what we must do is learn more and innovate more, which is less coming from the top, and it's more saying it's at your level where that knowledge resides. What we want is more innovation, so more experiments, but cheap, frugal experiments. We're going to have more experiments. We're going to kill them off sooner, and the ones that are successful scale up across the organization. So what we have is more experiments, but we do it cheaply. We don't spend a lot of money. So it's little expeditions to try things out rather than big, impressive things that fail. They come for more everywhere rather than just from the top. So broadly speaking, this is kind of the direction we're going. Partly it's where knowledge resides. And a second question about innovation, where does it come from? When you look at it, innovation often comes from small companies. What we see in the past is in pharmaceutical, they'd have huge R&D laboratories. But they found out in the last 10 years that more new drugs come from small companies. So we see in more industries where innovation occurs in small companies and big companies have a different role. Now, Hollywood's done this for many decades, where you have artists, writers, and then you have Sony, who sells these movies around the world. So they've done this for a long time, where book authors. Henry writes big-selling books. I write books. His sell. But, they, you know, we're not hired by a press, and they don't give us a lifetime contract to write for them. Henry writes a book, and they all want it, but he'll go to different publishers depending on what they can offer. But Henry and I are not working for one publisher. We don't get a salary. So a different business model. But we see this more broadly. There's a theory I'd like to propose to you. Is this on an angle, or is it all right? So it's a guy named Geoffrey Moore. Now, very few people can only quote from people that have the same last name. Okay? So I'm not related to Geoffrey Moore, but just one of those odd things. So Geoffrey took marketing adoption theory, which adoption theory said that you have growth, and then you have early adopters, later adopters, early majority, late majority, and laggards. Okay? So what he did is add a couple interesting dimensions to it, which I think are quite useful. Help us understand innovation today. So we look at here is we have the same kind of curve, which goes up like that, and it's called laggards over here. We have, this is not exactly the scale, but close enough, late majority, early majority. And here what he calls, sorry, are visionaries and pragmatists. The second group here, about here, is pragmatists. Now, if this is the revenue curve, what does the profit curve look like? Does anybody have a theory of what the profit curve would look like in this diagram? If the black line is revenue, what is the profit? Anybody have a theory? Okay, can you come up and draw it, please? So Hiro will draw this for us. So just put the green line where you think it is. Don't talk, just draw the line. Well, no, just draw it. Go draw it with the green. Okay, thank you. Anybody have a different theory of what the profit line looks like? Someone have a different theory? Come. Draw your, we should probably use a different color, shouldn't we? I don't have a different color. So do it with dots. Okay, we have two theories. Thank you. Do we have a third theory of what the profit curve looks like? Let me argue that the profit curve starts down here, that we're in a loss to start. But so, okay, we agree on that? Because we invested perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars in Panasonic for new products. We start down here. Oh, geez, maybe that's a little bit. And then it rises over time, and we'd agree profitability is around here somewhere. I think all three of us agree. The profitability is in the early majority. So as good business people, we want to get to early majority soon, as fast as possible, because that is where the money is. Okay? Now, I know you don't worry about money, but what we're looking at in the Kenyan Red Cross is if you want your ideas adopted, you want a lot of people to adopt them. So it's the same analogy. Is that fair enough? Okay. You want money as well? Oh, they have to. Okay, so this you can apply this to the hotel business. I wonder if that's an innovator's dilemma. Anyway, we'll leave that for another time. So we want to get here as soon as possible because that's where the money is. So to speed that up, we've got to understand these first two groups, the visionaries and the pragmatists. And what Geoffrey argues is that there's a chasm here. A chasm is like the Grand Canyon, is a very large chasm, right? So a big gaping thing which is hard to cross is a chasm. What he's saying is there's a chasm between the visionaries and the pragmatists. And it is about the nature of those two types of people. Visionaries, it's about 2.5%, 3% of the population. Visionaries will buy anything that's new. Do we like those as marketers? Do we like those people? We love them because they will buy when no one else will. So without them, we're out of luck. But the problem is there's only about 2.5% of them. They only get us partway to where we want to be. We love them, but there's not enough of them. Okay? So the pragmatists are around 12.5%. I mean, that's approximate. It might be a bit less or a bit more. They're very important because this is a social process. That these people, that's where the money is, won't buy until the pragmatists have bought. And the pragmatists won't buy until the visionaries buy. Okay? So that there's a social process of adoption. So my dentist has a machine which makes crowns for your teeth. You know, a crown or I'm not sure what they would call the other term, but what it is, you need a cap on your tooth. And so it used to be you'd go to the dentist, you have something wrong, and they put some, some mold, silicone or something, to mold your tooth. They'd send it off to a company where they'd build a tooth. They'd send it back, the dentist would put it on and spend an hour getting it to fit. What they've done now is they have a machine, a laser. So you sit there, the dentist takes a picture of your tooth on the machine, and you go there, and the machine has three or four lasers that builds your cap right in front of you. So the dentist goes on to make more money somewhere else, and you sit there and you watch the machine building your tooth. And the lasers come, they go, zzz, 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 and small children come by and look at it, and it's all very exciting. So the advantage of that is the dentist captures all the revenue rather than having to send it off to another company. So as business people, that's good. And I have one visit instead of two. So I'm happier. But my dentist would not buy this machine. He would not be the first dentist in Montreal to have it. See, the first dentist is a visionary. We love them, but they're not enough. And, this is important, they're weird. From the viewpoint of everyone else. Do you know people that will buy anything that's new high-tech product? They're not credible is the problem. Okay? Do you remember the Apple Newton? It came out, and within a week, the world knew it was a failure. But I have a friend who bought one. Because he's rich and he'll buy anything that's new. But I don't ask for his advice on new toys, because I'm not rich. I don't trust him. What it is that the visionaries are not seen as sensible business people. The pragmatists are. Comes from the word to be pragmatic, right? It's to be down to earth and to be useful. It's to be pragmatic. These people, if they adopt it, they will get you to the early majority where the money is. So they're critical to understand the pragmatists. Okay? So what you want to do to appeal to the pragmatists, you use the bowling alley approach. You know what bowling is? You have bowling? So in Canada, we have two types of bowling. We have 10-pin with a large ball. We also have a small ball that fits in your hand, and there's 5 pins. So this is just, I'm not sure I mentioned it, but I felt that we have to be different in Canada. So a bowling alley has pins, right? And you have pins that you hit this one and knocks the other ones down. Yes?
I just have one quick question. Don't you think you need visionaries and pragmatists for any line of product? Because if the visionaries don't have the courage to buy a new product so that everybody knows it works, then you won't get to the level of pragmatism where you achieve volume. Yeah. So I think you need people who are, probably, stupid or rich, like your friend, to experiment with whatever new product is on the market so that, all of us, chickens can also, learn from them and say, that thing works.
Absolutely.
Okay.
They're very, very important for sure, but we need to get beyond them. And what we see, there's a lot of technology is a problem looking for a solution. There's a famous saying in high tech, is a problem looking for a solution looking for a problem, rather. So you have technology, which is really neat, but we have no idea what to do with it. What you need to do with a pragmatist is find out what the problem is that this solves. So we love the visionaries, but we need to get to these people, and we treat them differently. Fair enough? Yes, Henry.
There's a connection, too, between the art, craft, science and strategic vision and strategic venturing in a way, because the visionaries are strategic vision that in the art corner, and the pragmatists are the craft people who kind of learn their way into new ways of
doing
things.
Yeah. So what we want to do is say, to get to the pragmatists, what I want to do is find out a niche where I can solve a business problem. So we're not talking, you know, someday it'll be wonderful, but that we can solve a real business problem that will make them corporate heroes, that they will advance their career by doing something very useful. So what you do is you get a product and you make it go after a niche, and you get that niche, which is very nice, but what you've seen then is that you've gone from the 2.5%, maybe you're up to 4%. It's not adequate. So you've got to use this to get to other niches. So you use this niche to knock down this niche, and you can go two ways. One way is that you can say, I have an application. Who else needs that same application? Or the other way is the relationship. So I have a relationship here with a company, and I will use that relationship to go after other niches. What you want to do is get to a point where you have a generic solution to a larger problem. Okay? So when that is, when you've got to that generic solution, you're looking at, you maybe got 15% of the adopters covered, you can then start going to the early majority in big ways. Okay? And really get substantial success. So this is a critical thing you need to do, is say, what niche should I go after where I'm going to solve a business problem, and I'll focus my product to that need. So I'm not going all over the place. I'm really focused. Then I'll use that to get to a generic solution. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, critical question is, what niche do you go after? Is a very critical one to decide. And you need to focus on that set of needs. Now, this goes back to our thinking about innovation, that we need more innovation. Where does it come from? It's more apt to come from small companies that do this, or within big companies, similar to the innovator's dilemma, a new organization. So we set up a new little company that's not going, it's going to protect from the corporate immune system that insists on a marketing plan and insists on return on investment, that insists on their customers loving it. Things that we can't get often with an innovation. So what we need to do is either start a small company, like, well, not that German Wings is small anymore, but separate off as a different organization, different culture, or we let this happen by many small companies. So it's a horse race. So in the horse race, what you have, I haven't been to a horse race, but you have a bunch of horses starting out, right, that are small companies trying to take a technology or a new product, new service to market. One or two will pull ahead of the others. What a big company then does is buy this one. So what you are is that this company has found a niche, found success, got a couple other niches, and it's starting to become attractive. So we separate, to some degree, innovation from what a big company does is buy the small company and gives them global distribution. You have thousands of IBM salespeople, HP, Microsoft, GE. So you have global distribution. So our job as a big company is to not so much innovate as to take those innovations to a broader market. So we see in pharmaceutical the separation to a large degree of innovation and the role of the big company.
Do you think there are companies sometimes they innovate with the vision that they want to grow this innovation and then to sell the company?
Oh, absolutely.
It's part of the structure.
See, when this theory first came out, Geoffrey Moore's theory, what Geoffrey said was saying, what you want to do is become the next Microsoft. Ride this up and become a billionaire, which is appealing to most people. But after a while, we came to conclude, studying it, is that it rarely worked. That there was occasional Bill Gates, but most failed. So we said, is instead of trying to do this, because once you get up here where you're starting to get some success, How do you hire 1,000 salespeople? Where do you have the money to pay them? Who would want to work for a small startup, et cetera, et cetera? So he said, don't bother trying to cross the chasm. What you do is you grow to a certain size, then you sell. What you do is you pretty yourself up to be bought by a big company. So a friend of my acquaintance was the head of Motorola Canada. So she got hired by a small company in Montreal that was a startup, and they brought her in, but she spoke fluent corporate ease. She knew how to speak big corporate, because it's a different language, isn't it, than a small company. And she knew she could go to GE in Crotonville, and they would say, she's one of us. And she knew how to make a company look nice for a big company, to have brochures, so that she could go and have dinner with them and sell it off to the big company. Then GE comes in, takes over the small company, and some people leave because they hate big companies. They're called entrepreneurs. So we give that entrepreneur a nice corner office. They're a vice president. They have a secretary. 6 months later, they're gone. But they say, I never want to go to another meeting in my life at this company. But you and I don't mind company meetings, right? I work for IBM. I've been at Lufthansa meetings. I've been at LG meetings. And I like it. It's sad, perhaps, but I enjoy that complexity. So it appeals to me, big organizations. Very different from the entrepreneur. And you'll meet an entrepreneur or two next week when you do your visits. Okay? So this is about innovation occurs in smaller companies, so we separate the two roles. Does that make sense? The challenge for the big company is how do we work with these small companies, how do we spot them, and how do we change our business model? Okay? Because this is about innovation and new ideas, but the bigger challenge for big companies is about how do we change our, and we've seen, you know, German Wings, we had to set up a whole different organization. Okay. So, Henry, I think we'd like to do a workshop now for the last 15 or 20 minutes on looking at emergent strategy. Okay. I guess, so at your table groups, the first question is, my organization, is it more deliberate or emergent strategy? Might be something to think about. But what was the second question you were suggesting, Henry? Do you recall?
How can you move to wherever you want to move if you want to stimulate more strategic learning?
In your organization, how might you do it? We're going to get into that next week when we talk about our forms of organizations, because some forms... apropos of yesterday and the first workshop where you have to kind of loosen up the organization, we're going to talk about how to do that on Sunday. But for now, the issue is, if you want to move towards more strategic learning and more emergent strategy, how might you do that?
I want to do that for 10 minutes in your table groups. Okay. He's had a couple other books since then.
think about how to contribute to that overall strategy. Because you cannot put that really complex business at each level only just in one or three or four sentences. So we have our own strategy, our own work, contributing to the overall. And this is exactly the way we do it by emerging. We learn.
And it's the deliberate strategy has to be there.
Yes, this is the corporate strategy. Of course, you can now ask how can this deliberate strategy, how can they learn more? And they can by our contribution to it. So there's feedback. I would say this is the situation with our group. In our group, so we are learning by just trying. I once was at a customer meeting, and a customer of us said, okay, he doesn't, external, and he said, okay, I have always to invest into my customers, because we are in a wholesale business, and he always had to invest in my customers, because I don't want to miss the next Microsoft. So this is something which really, I thought about it, and it's like in our technology business, you never know how it will develop. So you really have to try all opportunities, but then you have to find to a certain extent a point where you say stop, now you don't invest anymore, it makes no sense. It's a dead end road. And this is only by learning. To learn because money comes anyway. I think today this is really academic. This morning is really academic.
This module is more academic.
Probably the whole module.
Yeah.
I hate academics. I like action. You know, not just talking about how good. It's like we have to bring it. We have it to bring it.
Microsoft.
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting. I'll get you to make that comment. So we should... Carlos, isn't it? Okay. Just... So, if I could have your attention, please. Is anybody listening at all? Oh, okay. So, Carlos is one of our Sove scholars, worked for the government of Peru. Maybe you could just briefly tell me, just tell them what you told me.
To Google for some visits to stimulate some projects with the government, and we were talking with the Google people about their strategy, and they asked us, do you know who is our biggest competitor? And we say, well, since that you don't have a competitor, you're Google. And then they say, it's Microsoft. Why? Because we compete on who is going to buy the next Google. Like, so we are so worried about who's going to buy the next Google, either them or us.
So that's this model playing itself out there, the two big companies that love innovation. IBM is very much the same way. GE, they're looking for who do we pick up. Now, as an entrepreneur, the tension is, if I sell out too soon, I'm just rich, not filthy rich. If I wait too long, I might be selling the house. So there's a tension there because you need money to grow, but you got to give something up for that. So that's a very difficult decision to make. Not that money is important necessarily, but it's better to be rich than not if there's an option in your life, I suppose, along those lines where it's easy to do. So any comments or thoughts about how you make your organization more learning? Do you want to?
That's a question.
So you're saying, of course, but you're saying it's a question.
People in your company to learn, right? I mean, if you, why do I learn, or I look out for opportunities to learn? Because I have an inherent need to improve myself. So if the companies or the leaders doesn't want to improve or just want the status quo, the learning is not an emphasized quality in your people.
Okay. Well, we should have, no, it's interesting. It's an interesting point is that I agree not every company needs to do this. True. But broadly, I think most of us, we need more learning in our company. But I agree not everyone. And maybe your point, maybe they may need it, but they don't want it. So that may be fair. Practical ideas about how to be more learning. Does anyone have anything that they would like to share with us? And practically?
One of them is training.
Okay.
I every day struggle with that because my job is process improvement, so I want my company to be a learning organization. So four or five things that I do is that I make teamwork as one of the core functioning units, so there is learning. Secondly, making things visual, because by word speak, pictures speak much more than words, right? So if you can have a picture of improvement, that's much more, gives more opportunities for learning. So using, one is value streams. I don't know whether you understand value stream, 1 point lessons, and so many things. So, and also learning, because you adopt a new mental model of, you just look at it, other than let's look at it together, which is known as in lean methodology, the PDCA method of learning, so or A3 we call it. So there are many things that you need to do for making a company learning. Another thing is that you need to encourage risk-taking, because how do you learn? You learn things by doing things differently, because if you do the same things, you have no new learning. So you need to have sufficient appetite for risk-taking and experimentation and failures for you to learn. So all these ingredients have to be in a company for it to be a truly learning organization.
Okay. Can we have the mic over here, please?
No.
I think the one of the good way I found is facilitate internal competition. So maybe so current major business division, they tend to just focus on their product or their existing technology. So if we if we organize the two competing technology or products inside the one business division, then the major product or major technology possessing people tends to kill it. So we can do it in separate organization under the high level okay. of control. Then we can facilitate them. We can let them fight together, kind of. Mm. Then we can get a lot of lessons from their, you know, competition.
Okay. Very good. We have the mic over here. Oh, sorry. No, please go ahead.
At Target, we have, I think it's part of the culture. We have something called leadership expectations, and one of them is actually innovates. And in there, so there's a lot of rewards and recognition that even happens around the whole innovates, taking risk, championing new ideas, et cetera, et cetera. So we've made it very much part of the culture, which I think actually works at Target. So lots of good ideas come in. Think
so they've added it to your managerial performance, then?
Everybody, all the team members, and even up to a certain level in our goals and objectives, innovates would be something that we have to have one innovative idea over the year. That's something that we're going to implement. So it's in my goals and objectives, not a high weightage at the moment, but that's something that will grow, I guess. And even for the team members, when we do their annual reviews or anything, even if it's just a programmer, for example, we don't want you to just be copying and pasting code from somebody. What did you do as your idea to make something better? So innovates would become part of their goals and objectives or their assessment process as well. So it starts from a very low level all the way to the top, actually, and I think that works really well.
Okay.
Well, we had a discussion about how important it is to know what is going on at the front, so to say, that there's so much filtered out up to the top, which is going on where the people are working or doing the things. And there's so much knowledge and learning lost. So it's important to get these informations up to the ones who do the deciding, so to say. And the second idea was by Klaus, who said it would be interesting to have a small group of managers or whoever who is periodically questioning the core of the company. So in case of Lufthansa, why do we fly and what will happen to... What could happen that we don't fly anymore? Do we should do more Lufthansa video conferencing, whatever, just to change the view, just to be more open to developments?
You know, one thing I think often what happens with companies, we point to the top and just say, when they got themselves organized, it'd be wonderful. And that's not entirely untrue, but I think at your level, there's lots of room for trying little experiments, not a lot of resource, and then getting some evidence of success, and then you can take that forward. So that more humble approach seems to be one that fits with today's world, but it gives you an opportunity as middle managers to help on the innovative front. So, you know, it's because if you have some success, the people that have the resources to scale it and ability to are going to be more open to it. So I think actually proving something rather than just having a theory, it takes you further down that road. So that's very interesting. Well,
same idea, but in the same token, he said, if I had the budget to be able to do these experiments. So that's...
The question, how do you do without budget? Or secondly, how do you get, you know, maybe a good... company should provide a bit of budget like 3M does or Google does, provide some time and budget. But I guess the thought is, how, I mean, that's why the word frugal, what I meant by frugal is cheap, that is no budget. I mean, that's the extreme part of being frugal is no budget. But how can you try things out with using your existing budgets? There's a famous plane called the C-Series from being produced by Bombardier, and the auditors of Bombardier tried to find it because the guy who's now CEO loved it and kept it going even during when it was no longer officially part of what we were doing. He kind of kept some people working on it part-time. It helped that he was the son of the founder of the company. It was quite helpful. But you know, kept some things alive by being very frugal. So I think there's some options there. You can do things. But I agree, having a budget makes life much easier. There's no question about that. So let's end there. I presented two ideas this morning. The Innovator's Dilemma, and then the Geoffrey Moore idea of crossing the chasm. There are books around both of them, if you're so inclined. I think in the slides there's a reference to the book. But if you go on Amazon, you know, it would be there as well. So there are two ideas to help you think about innovation and where threats and opportunities can come from. And in big organizations, how do we become more flexible? So there's some ideas and thinking. And again, the meta idea was that of deliberate versus emergent strategy, that it's the Porter view of, which is useful, but it's more of an old view of the way the world used to be, like my 20-year plan. Not a bad idea. It did go off the rails after 3 years, so I only held to it for 3 years. But in this world today, we think about emergent strategies around learning, and you know, Henry talked about it at some length. So that's a little bit of the summary of what we did this morning. What we're doing now is we're going for a walk on the mountain, and Dora, or Sarah, will share. Ah, there we are. Oh, sure.
To our guests, we thank you. This has been an experiment. We will get it better and better as time goes on. If you we're going up the mountain, maybe you can show them. Can you show them the mountain? And if you want to go up the mountain, you're going to have to come to the IMPM yourselves. Bye.